This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 93.
We don't build skill unless we have bonds of trust and respect. That's it. That's what connection means. But the other part of that bond is the meaning associated with the work, the meaning associated with the bond. Like, my motivation to be better has a lot to do with the fact that I want you to respect me. I'm trying to come up here and I want to earn your trust and respect. That's important to me. And vice versa, from the expert's chair, you want to leave a legacy. You got really lucky. You have some great skill and you want to help that next generation. That's meaningful personally to you. It's part of what makes your life worth it. We don't talk about skill in terms of the meaning in our lives, but really they're super connected.
How can we learn to work with intelligent machines and generative AI? Why is the human connection so critical to learning new skills? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Hey everyone, if you've been listening to the podcast, then you know I am incredibly passionate about inspiring and developing the next generation of HR leaders. But you may not know that I'm also passionate about speaking to and working with HR organizations to enhance their capabilities. In fact, one of the coolest things that's happened since I've launched the podcast is that several HR organizations have asked me to speak about the future of HR and support their efforts to develop their HR teams. It's been an incredible honor to work with these HR organizations, and I'm looking to have an even bigger impact in the future. If you'd like me to speak to your HR organization, or if I can ever be helpful in building the capability of your HR team, please reach out as I'd love to hear from you. I want to take a moment to thank this episode's sponsor, Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. I'm a big fan of their assessments because they accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. But don't take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals' core drivers assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, that's /futurepod, and take the core drivers assessment for free. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guest, Matt Bean. Matt is the author of an important new book, The Skill Code: How to Save Human Ability in the Age of Intelligent Machines. I highly recommend you pick up Matt's book as it is so relevant to not only understanding how AI and other technologies impacting work and learning today, but where it's heading and the role that HR leaders can play in shaping that future. In addition to being an author, Matt is also an assistant professor in the Technology Management Department at University of California, Santa Barbara. And he's also a digital fellow with Stanford's Digital Economy Lab and MIT's Initiative on the Digital Economy. His award-winning research has been published in top management journals such as Administrative Science Quarterly and Harvard Business Review, and he has spoken on the TED stage. He also took a 2-year hiatus from his PhD at MIT Sloan's School of Management to help found and fund Humanix, a full-stack Internet of Things startup. This was a fascinating and important conversation as Matt and I discussed why we are sacrificing learning for productivity with technology like generative AI and robotics, why mentors, coaches, and apprenticeships are more important than ever before, how challenge, complexity, and connection are critical to developing valuable skills, why organizations need to shift their mindset from skills plus AI to skills times AI, and why he believes that learning development is the new number one function in every organization, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode as you listen. Just drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And with that, let's jump into my conversation with Matt. Matt, welcome to the Future of HR Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Delighted to be here. This is a really fun opportunity. So thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast and thank you for writing the skill code. I mean, this is some really impressive impressive work, but it's important work. And I was lucky enough to be at the I4CP conference and see your presentation, which I can tell you everyone was blown away, not only by the insights, but what you were saying. I think a lot of us had not been thinking about this. And so let's start getting to know you. You spent your career studying and working around machine intelligence and specifically robotics and how that impacts our lives, how we work, how we interact, and where that's going in the future. And so where did this passion come from, studying robotics, machine intelligence? It's so unique.
Yeah, my mom will tell you is like maybe age 4 or 5. And it's sort of true. My life has not been a straight arrow kind of professional trajectory, but I still own the copy of the Usborne series book printed in the 70s with a giant robot on the cover, Robots in the Future and Computers or something like that. So since I was a kid, I've been sort of fascinated by technology. But the next meaningful tack was in the mid-2000s. I was in consulting specifically around sort of human dynamics at work. I was working at a firm doing process facilitation for executive teams and so on. And the BlackBerry came along. I'm dating myself here. But that, I watched that moment happen in teams and realized, whoa, that's really changing how people are treating each other. What information shows up in the room? Stuff like that. Then it was around the mid-2000s that all these books started to come out, some of them more grounded and reasoned and some of them a little bit more out there about AI. That was the sort of a moment. And I read them all because I'm a nerd on that stuff. And then I saw a study coming out of MIT, out of the Media Lab. Sandy Pentland's a guy who runs a lab there called the Human Dynamics Lab. They had built a sensor that you could wear around your neck, had a bunch of sensors built into it. And if everyone in your group was wearing this, you could measure in real time and show people on a display how much they were hogging the conversation, how well they were doing at turn-taking, stuff like that. That was 40% of my very well-paid job. I swear, I would show up to executive teams and it was like playing traffic cop, just like, you haven't spoken as much as everybody else. What are your thoughts? The machine leveled that immediately with no human intervention. And it was a janky prototype. But I saw that study and I went, wow, my career, my profession has a half-life. I was volunteering as a research assistant for some folks and so on. My wife finally turned to me and said, you're talking a lot about this stuff. You either need to go back to school or just like get back to your dang job. She didn't say it in those words. It was very loving. And I said, well, this is a terrible time. She was founding a business of her own at the time. She's an executive coach. She gave me this look. She goes, when's a better time? And so I applied to school. Then MIT let me in. Then we looked at each other like, all right, we're really doing this, aren't we? So I showed up there and within 6 months announced robots. And everybody kind of went, whoa, that was a little different than your I did mention robots and AI in my application. I was more kind of AI, work teams, digital stuff. But when you arrive there, they give you a pretty strong speech like, look, you came here because you're weird. We let you in because you've got something that you want to go after that nobody else has quite gone after yet. You better figure out what that is. No fooling around. Now, different folks give that speech different ways. And I had no rational explanation for it, but I was like, well, robots. And people went, cool. And instantly, the minute you kind of, it's like a life lesson, I think. The instant you declare yourself, I'm going to study how people deal with robots at work. They're like, yeah, let me make some intros for you. And in 9 months, I was doing my first field research on the night shift in a post-surgical ICU with this telepresence robot and how that changed the way that work dynamics shifted and stuff. And it was just off to the races after that.
Wow, that's an incredible story. So you've really made a full career transition, went back to MIT, which is not easy to get into at all.
Okay, correct.
Just be very clear, it's a very good school. And then from there, you said, I'm going to become a robot expert and get into it. And that's what you did. And that's incredible. What an incredible story. And really, I guess the skill code is really like a lot of what you've learned over this time period. And so let's talk about this book that you've written, Skill Code, How to Save Human Ability in the Age of Intelligent Machines. Why did you write the skill code? And what do you hope people take away, Matt?
Part of the answer to any big life question like this is that none of us really know. Somebody said, you should write a book. And part of me just, not rational part of me just went, yeah, that feels right. So it was a gut thing. What I did realize, though, intellectually, and this is really true, I've been studying micro style, like show up, hang out in a workplace for a minimum of a year, day in, day out, take notes on how people do stuff, interview them about their work and so on. And I had done a number of these studies of very different kinds of robots, very different kinds of settings, warehousing, elder care, knowledge work, obviously surgery, and so on. And then started to familiarize myself with other folks' research who were also studying work involving intelligent tech. And this was around 2016, 2018, something like that. I started to realize the barriers and opportunities around skill building at work that are really highlighted, intensified with these technologies and the places that I was going to look. They're showing up everywhere. I wrote an HBR article about that, sort of saying, look, this is kind of an all hands on deck thing. Like, this isn't just a robotic surgery problem. And the basic problem I saw there was you put this new technology in place and it's great for the expert. They're more productive, whether it's a robot or AI, but that means the novice has less opportunity to play because the expert is more self-sufficient. That shows up really different ways in different contexts, in B2B sales versus investment banking versus policing versus in the kitchen, different workplaces, but same base dynamic. And I was finding folks who were finding their skill anyway, in spite of those barriers, and they were all doing it in the same way across all those contexts, really consistently. That was enough fodder for me to realize there's a deeper story here about what allows skill building, like reliable skill, real valuable skill that you can count on in a pinch. What allows that to get built in the first place? Then what's getting in the way right now in terms of how we're handling technologies? And then what can we do about it? That's a three-part story. That's what the book is. Part one, here's how we build skill, really honestly, all the research that's available out there, plus my own. The middle part is we're nuking that thing right now. By the way, we're handling these technologies. We don't have to. The opposite can and needs to be true. And that's part three, basically. In academia anyway, writing these kind of books before tenure, I don't have tenure yet as a professor, is generally viewed as a bad move because it doesn't count. But I felt like it was a really important message to get out there, because if it's really true, I mean, you're talking to the guy who believes it's true because he sort of uncovered it. If we don't course correct, the status quo is going to destroy our ability to build skill right when we need to be building skill the most. That needs to be healthy immediately. The realization right there made me think, book, yes, I should do that. And I got to get out there and start making some noise about this, because take this in exactly the right way. COVID helped with this in that folks going remote was great on many dimensions, but instantly started to hurt around the kind of visceral, curious learning that we get just by hanging around with each other, collisions at work, getting to overhear stuff, help in a pinch, that kind of stuff. Just the volume got turned way. That's, I think, the short story about why the book.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Matt. If you are a fan of the future of HR, then you know that I believe the organization with the best talent wins. So how do you ensure that you are selecting and developing the talent that will help your organization to win? The answer lies in using a scientific, data-driven approach to assessing and developing your talent, and that's where Deeper Signals comes in. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessment platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. Why am I such a big fan of Deeper Signals? With Deeper Signals, you can accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. You can generate personalized action plans and development journeys that equip leaders, individuals, and teams with the insights needed to improve onboarding, help them grow, and increase their overall performance. And the best part, Deeper Signals is affordable, user-friendly, and scalable, making it accessible to organizations of all sizes. No wonder over 400,000 people from over 140 countries have completed their assessments, and companies like Caterpillar and S&P Global are loyal customers. But don't just take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals Core Drivers Assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod. That's future P-O-D. And take the Core Drivers Assessment for free. It's normally $65 per assessment, but Deeper Signals has agreed to give Future of HR listeners this limited time opportunity to try the assessment risk-free. So what are you waiting for? Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, P-O-D, and complete the 7-minute core drivers assessment. I know you'll be impressed with the results. And with Deeper Signals, you'll have the scientific, data-driven approach you need to select, onboard, and develop the talent that'll help your organization to win today and into the future. And there was a recent working paper called GPTs for GPTs, which I'll link to in the show notes. And it kind of struck me because you talked about this in your presentation that 80% of the US workforce could have at least 10% of their work tasks impacted by large language models, and 19% of the workforce could have up to 50% impacted by large language models or generative AI. Talk more about this research and how generative AI and other things are starting to impact our work and our society.
The key thing to say right now is that this is only just starting to happen. And anybody who says they know exactly what's going on and where it's going to go is selling something. However, that paper, I think, is a really important one to pay attention to. Daniel Rock is one of the co-authors there. He's at the Wharton School Management at University of Pennsylvania. He's a collaborator of mine on a different paper, actually a couple different papers. And Pamela Mishkin's at OpenAI. The rest of the other authors are at OpenAI, the company that makes ChatGPT. Their basic discovery, it was a modeling paper. So this is like, they took all known jobs and all the tasks associated with those jobs, and they used ChatGPT itself, like an LLM, to go assess how much each of those tasks was exposed to an LLM. And by exposed, they meant something very particular. It didn't mean it's going to get taken away, it's going to get automated. It just means if that person's doing that task, they can be significantly more productive if they used an LLM on that task. So they can do better or faster, or a combination of the two. And so if your job is 10% exposed, that just means in 10% of your job, you could do significantly better if you took this raw technology and used it. By the way, in that abstract of that paper, which I didn't mention in my presentation, all that is pre-appification of ChatGPT. Like, Microsoft is now building that stuff into their Office suite. If you look at their modeling assumptions there, the numbers are much bigger because it is much easier to use. It's built into everything kind of seamlessly. So this is just for like the equivalent of getting raw electricity brought to your home with a motor. And how many people can get more out of that than they could out of a horse? It would take some jerry-rigging, but you could do it. That's the 80-10 thing. And by the way, that's 80% of the global workforce, not just the US workforce. So that's like 2.7 billion people right now today, 10% of their job, they can do significantly better.
And then to your point, it's not customized AI apps that are now starting to actually do parts
they
of people's
are.
Jobs, which if you look at like the music app that just came out this week, the video apps yep. are incredible. Those are not just one person's job. That could be multiple people's jobs across the board.
Right. And one orientation on this is that those jobs are going away or are threatened. And that is understandable. And there's research to support that. Anybody who says that's not going to happen is underinformed. At the same time, anybody who says it's all destruction, waste, and problem is also underinformed. Like, what we tend to do over time is we tend to move folks to new jobs that didn't exist before, or they take these new tools and they can just do more and better. And it turns out that the world's demand for certain things is infinite. So you can become a 10x accountant. That means there's going to be 10 times as much accounting work done on the planet. It's not that accountants are going to go away, right? We don't really know, but I think you're absolutely right. We ain't seen nothing yet, really.
Yeah, I think that's just, it's mind-boggling how fast it's changing. You've also said, and I think this was like, it really hit me when you said in the presentation and your book that we're sacrificing learning for productivity with technology like generative AI and robotics. Just tell us more about why you say that.
Yes. I'll just ground it out in the surgery example because that's a very vivid one for folks and it makes the case. I will say though that the book is now focused on all work because I think this example that I happened to catch early is showing up in lots of places now. You can imagine the basic dynamic, which is in the old-fashioned method of doing surgery, if you and I were doing surgery, you're my mentor. You need four hands to do that procedure at once. I might not be doing the most complicated thing. In fact, that's probably you. But you need me to, I won't get graphic, do stuff to keep things moving along. That means I'm swimming the whole time. If the procedure's 4 hours long, I'm sweating and focused for 4 hours with you. And you and I have a special bond. We're trying to get something done that really matters. One way or another, I'm building neuronal connections the whole time. I'm learning a lot. And you have a lot of degrees of freedom. You can sort of give me more challenge as it seems like I need it. You can expose me to different new things as we're going. Or if it looks like I'm struggling too much, you can dial it back and have me do different stuff. So really rich tapestry of collaboration and skill development. Robotic surgery, you have a tool. You could, in a pinch, do the whole thing yourself. No problem. You sit down at a console. You have two hand, they're called masters. You have these hand controllers that are really fancy, and you use your feet. You can control this robot using your hands and feet, and you have three arms inside the patient to control, two that do what you might think of as surgery. And the third one is like a retraction thing. So you can grab some tissue, hold it up, lock that in place, let go, and go operate with your hands while that arm just stays right where it is, perfectly stationary. That's like having that other person. That was the idea. It meant that more people could do safer surgery. It's also scaled down. So 1 inch on the outside is a millimeter inside kind of thing. Bottom line, that for you, the expert, is fantastically great. You can be more focused, take your time. You can pause and relax, take your hands off the controls and so on. So it, for you, of course, you're going to prefer that. Most people would. The institution loves it because you're more productive. And it's safer and patients don't stay as long in the hospital. So the hospital loves this. The industry loves this. The only person who's not loving it is the trainee because they sit there with their arms folded for 4 hours and they're lucky to get 10 to 15 minutes of, A, they're lucky if there's a trainee console involved, which allows them to even take control without having that surgeon have to stand up out of that console, then sit down. If there is a trainee console and they mess up even a little bit, maybe twice, that surgeon's just going to tap a touchscreen right in front of them and they're out of the pool instantly. And by the way, everyone heard why in the whole OR. So it's not a pleasant experience. 10 to 15 minutes, maybe five, if you're lucky, 12 times over a 5-year residency, and then you're legally empowered to go use that thing on patients.
That kind of, that seems scary. That doesn't seem like enough.
Yeah. Now, it's a really extreme case. And I would assume there'd be people are like, well, aren't there all these injuries and complications and so on now? And we don't have really good studies of that. The results across the board look like you're getting comparable results between robotic and non-robotic procedure. I think it can and should be way better. And part of the reason it is not is the issue I'm talking about, but that requires research. So that fraying of the bond right there that I just described, start to think about other occupations, other professions, other industries. Just the move to virtual, or now that you can use ChatGPT as that expert, how many times do you need to turn to me, the novice who's looking to collaborate with you? How much less do you need me? The minute you've got that bit flipped, I defy you to go look in a workplace where this kind of thing is subtly not happening.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's happening in a lot of places. And so much of what we learn is really apprentice style, learning from somebody else, learning by watching, learning by doing. And that example you had is interesting because to your point, you know, it's not a computer. It's a person who knows how to dial up or back when the learner needs more. And so if you start taking that away, there's less human interaction. There's less learning, less opportunities to learn. And I worry about our kids. How do they learn certain things? Over time, the skill go away. It starts to be atrophy. And now we're looking to the robots or generative AI or whatever it is to have the skill versus the person. Is that kind of where you see maybe a little too dystopian, but you know, is that kind of where you're headed towards if we continue to rely too much on robotics and generative AI?
That's kind of a 2 or 3 clicks farther into the future than I tend to think. But certainly that is why 2018, I was on the TED stage, 2019, that HBR piece came out. Like right around then I went, this is an all hands on deck kind of problem. Like we've got to address this. So lots of, it's not going to be all bad. It's not going to be all good. But I see if we don't change this dynamic, if we don't find new ways to allow people trying to learn to get to the kind of high contact, vicarious learning on the job that we take for granted, we've taken for granted for thousands of years, if we don't find a way to reinvigorate that right now, I do think we're going to see some significant and serious problems arise for individuals, for entire professions, but also for our society and organizations, because change is happening. There are people who say change is happening faster than ever. It kind of does seem like that up close living in it today, doesn't it though? I mean, separate from that, an organization is only as good as its people. And if there's a lot of change going on and that organization needs to pivot and adapt and flex, where does that come from? Somebody's ability on the ground to notice some strange situation, adapt to it, and have the skill to cope with it. So if we're atrophying those skills right now, that seems like the worst possible It's pretty bad. Maybe not worst possible. So I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know I'm very confident that if we don't do something about this issue, it's just kind of more bad than we want, is what I'll say.
Fair. Maybe I was a little too far down that path.
You might be right.
A Black Mirror episode, right. You know, where we all lose all control of certain things and robots control our lives. But more importantly, let's focus to where we can do. And I think looking in your book, you found three C's, challenge, complexity, and connection, that really are the basic components of how we develop valuable skills. Talk more about the insights around that and the implications for organizations on how to use the three C's.
Sure. The short story on where those three things came from is that the people who managed to learn in spite of the barriers that I've been talking about across occupations and professions were fighting to protect these three things. I looked across all these cases and I tried to figure that out. I had rough names for them, like, okay, struggle seems important. So challenge. Also, a broader view of what they were doing rather than just a super focused, I'm trying to build this skill here. And that turned into complexity, which is, yeah, get good at the thing you're trying to get good at, but also what else is going on around you? Understand the broader system. What other skills might you be interested in? What are all these other people doing? And the third bit is human connection. All of these folks in all these circumstances are fighting for each of these three. So that was the genesis for the book in a way. Then I went and looked at the research and lo and behold, by different names in different circumstances, psychology, kinesiology, anthropology, sociology, economics, you name it, there's research that shows that we don't learn unless we are pushing ourselves close to, but not beyond our current capability, where we are focused and doing less well than we normally would. That's the place where you're learning the most, and it is unpleasant. Do a lot to help people avoid feeling unpleasant and so on. And so we can slip off that pretty naturally. And the middle part is you're doing your job, but you need time to reflect. You need time to understand the broader system. I have been studying warehousing recently. I have a warehousing director who got good at running her line and then started to wonder about the finances of the building. Like, huh, how do we make money around here, right? That's a complementary set of skills. And she got good enough at her local jam to start to ask questions. But a different person would have asked about maintenance or something. It's up to them. Those three things both showed up in my own research as the keys, shadow learners, I called them, the folks who were bending rules to get their skill. They were insisting on, and they're in the research. That was enough to convince me that the book was a worthy target.
And the third part was the connection piece.
Yes.
Finding people to learn from as well.
Well, and really, we don't build skill unless we have bonds of trust and respect. That's it. That's what connection means. There's a lot of research traditions on this, and there's two ways in which that's true. One is you don't get to play unless somebody trusts you to give you a shot. So it's an access thing. Like, let's say we're back to the surgery thing. I did pretty good in that surgery yesterday, you think, my mentor. That means you're going to give me more of a shot next time. Or I look good on paper, so maybe you'll let me into your residency program. So there's a relationship of trust and respect that has to happen at each phase for me to get that next little bit of access to build my skill. But the other part of that bond is the meaning associated with the work, the meaning associated with the bond. Like, my motivation to be better has a lot to do with the fact that I want you to respect me. I'm trying to come up here and I want to earn your trust and respect. That's important to me. And vice versa, from the expert's chair, you want to leave a legacy. You got really lucky. You have some great skill and you want to help that next generation. That's meaningful personally to you. It's part of what makes your life worth it. We don't talk about skill in terms of the meaning in our lives, but really they're super connected. And that's shot through the research too. Like, lots of psychological research shows that a feeling of competence in this life, the ability to produce results under pressure, it's core to who we think we are, what life means in general. Anyway, yes, human connection is absolutely critical and is really kind of written out of a lot of papers, especially academic ones about what skill's about and how you build it. It sounds very kind of like practice this thing and you'll get good. Separate from why? Where did you get that motivation? Where did you get that idea? Who cares? Who's even going to give you a shot? Like, all that stuff has to do with our human bonds.
Yeah, it's so great you brought that up and just underlining the fact of having that purpose and mastery and autonomy to make that impact. And it's so personal for people, right? Whatever you're doing, you just take a lot of pride in that. Like writing a book. You don't write a book unless you've got a purpose behind that. Like, there's something bigger for you. And so I think that's just so critical. And it's actually more important, I almost think, now than ever. And I think after COVID shifted it, where people are prioritizing this over other things when they think about how they choose their career, how they spend their time?
I think so, certainly for me. I can tell you without question that there are people I looked up to who had helped me along the way, where a part of my motivation was, this book has got to be great. Yes, I have a mission. I want to help the world. But those people, I've got them in my mind. I want them to read this book and think, dang, Bean is really doing a good job. I'm impressed. I want them to feel proud of me. No question about it. You don't absolutely need all these three things to be healthy to build skill. I want to be really clear. It's not like you don't get any skill unless they're all perfectly healthy. It's just that there's a 10-point checklist for each one in the book. If you are solid on those 10-point checklists, you're going to learn way better, faster. But for sure, I had those kind of people in mind. I could almost see their faces, like they better be smiling. That's really important.
Well, Matt, you also said that organizations need to be thinking about skill plus AI and skill times AI or multiplied by AI. Tell us more about what you mean by that and what are the skills required to do this well?
There's a lot of talk out there about skill or AI, by the way, like especially in education, ground zero for me, people are like, don't allow ChatGPT in the classroom. It's either you learn to write or you learn to use ChatGPT and you're not going to get both. That is a real and significant concern in some contexts. I'm not going to write it off. The more I look at those kind of scenarios, there's usually a way to have your cake and eat it too. So if you redesign how you approach that topic or challenge, you can get better results because of the technology. So that's the skill plus AI bit. Bomb disposal is a great example that I mentioned in that presentation that you were at that happened accidentally, as far as I can tell, where before robots, bomb disposal was, it was very difficult for a trainee to learn from the expert because the expert was 100 meters away, tinkering around with a potentially explosive device in a sound bombproof suit in 109 degree heat. And they're not going to be chatting a lot about what they're doing and why. So it's real hard for that trainee 100 meters away to understand and learn. Really difficult. The robot allowed that trainee and the mentor to sit in a truck together. And the trainee, because they were raised by a PlayStation, they just take this controller and they drive that robot. And the expert is kind of talking the trainee through what to do. So much richer. That's the skill plus AI bit, right? So the robot gets involved and there was accidental, but we can do this on purpose. We can make it so that you bring the tech in and it enriches that natural learning connection. And by the way, dramatically improves productivity at the same time. You can totally get both. Not always, but if we're not even trying, we're not going to know when we can get both. The skill times AI bit, I think, is the, in a way, the unique provenance of HR, talent development and talent management in organizations. And I wrote a post about this in my Substack 2 months ago now called Learning and Development, the New Number One Function in Every Organization, basically. Here's why. So the kind of bomb disposal example that I mentioned is important, but what's really needed and necessary is to rework the entire fabric of how learning happens in an organization, because you can't count on a business leader in a function. You can't count on an expert who's looking for better results to both take a new technology like ChatGPT and put it to use, but also ask the question, how could I do this in a way that helps the next person down the chain? Because the immediate productivity that you get out of that tool is like saccharin. It's this giant sugar hit to any business unit. You're going to want to put it to use. That expert is happy. They're getting better results. The business unit sees either slightly improved or significantly improved productivity. They don't have the incentive to notice like, oh, that novice is languishing over there. They're not involved as much. Or they don't get a chance to accidentally run into this other person in the hallway as they're gathering files for a meeting over here and have a conversation about a potential deal that they wouldn't have learned about otherwise and so on. They don't have the visibility into it. They're going to see the productivity first, focus on that generally. And they don't have the expertise around what constitutes good, healthy learning that the HR and talent functions have. Even if they saw some sort of issue, oh yeah, that novice person's complaining about something or other, they're not going to know like, well, is that affecting their learning? One. And two, how would I know? What indicators would I look for? What's the science of learning? How do people actually learn stuff? Everybody's got their own lay theory around that. And people make million-billion-dollar decisions on that basis, and they are wrong. They're not experts in how people actually build skill, really. They'll think classes, training, that's easy to point to. Let's send people to more training and so on. Oh, they just need to be retrained. That gives you table stakes for doing your job. Training is critical to get you the knowledge you need so that you understand the situation. But building skill, as you said, and this is in the book too, is a product of do, try, struggle, collaborate, earn. It's challenge, complexity, and connection in real work. That's lost on many business leaders as well. So I feel like this skill times AI thing is forget a particular application. Now we need a new infrastructure for learning. This is like building into our IT systems for the organizations, our HR systems and so on, talent management systems, but also work rotation systems, all these things that we used to do to try to help people get ahead in their career. Those can be amplified and enriched with AI as well. Now we can make an AI-enabled match between you and a potential mentee or a potential mentor and you that no human being could notice because they don't grok the data well enough. They can't see that opportunity. We need to build, again, talent management. HR is in really the leader's chair on this one because they understand those systems that have been used, how AI might enrich or empower them so that they can help this learning game improve while getting better results. So I think it's a huge opportunity for refreshed relevance for HR. It's a critical mission right now, and the business is just not going to notice it, as far as I've been able to tell. Some leaders will, but they certainly need to invite the chief people officer, chief HR officer into the room when big tech decisions are getting made around, are we going to give everybody ChatGPT in the organization or not? The question is, yes or no, important question, but how? Are you going to do it in a way where you get your productivity and build skill at the same time? That's not a question that most CEOs are accustomed to thinking or asking. That's a much more closer to home base for somebody who's dealt with talent their whole career.
Yeah, that is the key question of how we implement AI. Is it going to augment and build skills, replace skills altogether? I think that's the big question. What are your recommendations, Matt, on how learning development and talent leaders or HR leaders just elevate their game and take a more proactive leadership role in generative AI?
That same post I mentioned in my Substack was my best first pass recipe. It has a step zero and a step one, and I've now gotten some feedback on that. They seem to be, and the stress testing seems to hold up. Step zero, I call put your own Gen AI mask on before helping others, basically. You've got to roll up your sleeves and burn or some subset of your folks. But probably if you're the leader of your function, you do need to personally do this. It is a sacrifice in time. But you've got to struggle on a problem that you wouldn't have even tried to solve before at all. Like, not write an essay faster, but like code up a website and post it and have it include a data analytics engine. Do you know how to do that? Absolutely not. Can you now do it with 8 to 12 hours of effort? Yes, you can. So the double value added way to do this is to do it on a problem that your business unit already struggles with, some data that they already have to deal with, so that not only do you build your Gen AI sort of in your bones skill and understanding what it can do, but you also have improved your credibility with your partner in the business, right? They will see that you have struggled through and analyzed some data that they have to deal with on sales reports, for instance, or you pick your data set, and that you found some new data analytics insight in it on your own and you don't know how to code. That's impressive on two levels. That can show them both what's possible, but also that you're willing to roll up your sleeves and really understand their business to their satisfaction. Step one is to go about solving the problem we've been talking about for the last half hour, right? So once those business leaders understand that you are a credible player in this space, then it's time to wake them up that they are sacrificing skill for productivity. They're sacrificing learning for productivity. They don't know it. They won't see it. And they need you in the room when it's time to make big decisions, because always the question, and it's a simple question. Beyond this, there's other useful questions to ask. But the simple question is, how can we get our productivity out of that, dear vendor, and build the skill of our people at the same time while they're using your technology? Most vendors will go, never heard that one before. And then the CEO can say, that's excellent. Please come back in a week with an answer. In that piece as well, and in a couple others on my Substack, I offer things that individuals can do in how they configure these tools so that at the end of each session with ChatGPT, you have a little bit more skill than you did at the beginning, because you can slide downhill yourself. Watch out. But that's not servicing a business. So how to do that for a whole business with an enterprise scale implementation? Honestly, that's what executives and heads of HR and talent need to collaborate on and figure out. And it's not a straightforward question, and it'll be done iteratively. It should be attempted. There'll be places that works and places it doesn't. But the basic question is, how can we get our productivity and our skill at the same time for the people who are using your system? That's the core question.
That is a great question and the right question to ask. And I think we'll be trying to figure out how to answer that question over the next few years, and different organizations will be tackling different ways. But what's great about HR and the communities, I feel like people will be sharing as they learn those things. HR practitioners love to share. Here's what we're learning. Here's how you can do that. So that makes us better. Last question for you, Matt. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I hope this will define HR. I think there's a very, very great chance this can, which is renewed relevance, or just relevance. I'm not going to repeat all the stuff that everybody in talent management and HR is used to hearing about HR's value or role in the organization. And that's had ups and downs over the decades. But I think if, to the extent that HR professionals and functions are proactive, you can name and focus on this issue in a way that shows it is a business critical topic. And really, there's nobody else sitting at the table who has the expertise to guide the business in dealing with it. That means instant. If you make that case and you make it well, you're at the table every single time because you're the local expert on how your organization runs, the people in it, and how to take these technologies and bring them in the organization in a way where 1 + 1 = 3 for people and skill. Relevance to me, if to the extent HR capitalizes on this opportunity, the next 10 to 15 years look really bright, intense, full of change like we haven't seen anything yet. But no one will start a meeting without HR in the room, if to the extent that folks make that happen.
Relevance. Matt, your book is relevant. The Skill Code, How to Save Human Ability in the Age of Intelligent Machines. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing all of your great insights and research.
My distinct pleasure, honestly. I really appreciated the invite and hopefully it's helpful.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Matt for sharing his research and insights on his new book, The Skill Code. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Lucian Alzeri. Lucian is the Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer for Prudential Financial, a Fortune 50 financial services company. Lucian has over 30 years of experience in major international companies and has been CHRO at A.P. Moller Maersk, a global shipping and energy conglomerate, and Avon Products. Lucian is also a fellow and director of the National Academy of Human Resources, which is the highest honor in our field, a founding member of HR 50, and recently concluded a 3-year term as chair of the board of advisors of the Center for Executive Succession at the University of Southern California. Lucian is one of the best in the business, and in this conversation, we talked about the fundamental truths of HR that have remained constant throughout his career, what sets the best CHROs apart from the rest, the importance of decision logic in HR, and why the next big capability in HR is expertise in work, and much, much more. This was a great conversation and one you won't want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.